founder Acharya Srila Prabhupada ki jai, Ananta Koti Vaishnava Vrinda ki jai, Namacharya Srila Haridas Thakur ki jai, Prem Shri Gaur Shri Krishna Chaitanya Prabhu Nityananda Shri Advaita Gadadhar Shri Vasadi Gaura Bhakta Vrinda ki jai, Shri Shri Radha Krishna Gaur Gopina Shyamakunda Radha Kunda Giri Govardhana ki jai, Vrindavan Dhamma ki jai, Mathura Dhamma ki jai, Navajit Mayapur Dhamma ki jai, Jagannath Puri Dhamma ki jai, Ganga Maya Jumun Devi ki jai, Bhakti Devi ki jai, Tulsi Maharani ki jai, Samaveta Bhakta Vrinda ki jai, Gaur Premanande. All glories to the assembled devotees. All glories to the assembled devotees. All glories to the assembled devotees. All glories to Sri Guru and Gauranga. All glories to Srila Prabhupada. Nama Om Vishnu Padaya. Krishna Prasthaya Bhutale Srimati Bhakti Vedanta Swami Niti Namane. Namaste Sarasvati Deve Gauravani Pacharani Nivasesa Sinivani Paskatya De Satarani. Vandeham Sri Guru Sri Yuta Padakamalam Sri Gurun Vaishnavamscha. Sri Rupam Sagrajatam Sagana Raghunatham Vitam Stam Sajivam. Sadvaitam Sadvadutam Parijana Sahita Krishna Chaitanya Devam. Sri Radha Krishna Padam Sahagana Lalita Sri Vishakam Vitamscha. Panchakapachubhishtra Kibasindhviyavita Patitanam Pavanevya Vaishnavevya Namo Namaha. Om Namo Bhagavate Vasudevaya. Om Namo Bhagavate Vasudevaya. Om Namo Bhagavate Vasudevaya. So, today is February 20th, 2021. And this is from the Bhakti Center in New York over Zoom. And can you give me the ability to share my screen, please?
Yes, except one thing, Bhattaji, this is not the Bhakti Center.
Oh, it's not.
Excuse me.
I'm sorry.
26 Second Avenue.
It's 26 Second Avenue. Yes, sorry.
And let me add, this is a very wonderful day because we have the fortune of hearing Mother Irmala give class to us in Bhagavad Gita to share Krishna consciousness with us.
Hare Krishna. I'm sorry I got you mixed up with the Bhakti Center. So this is 26 Second Avenue, where everything began. And yes. What a privilege.
To be able to share.
Got it? Can you see?
Yes.
Excellent. Okay, so reading from Bhagavad Gita, Chapter 2, Contents of the Gita Summarized, Text 33. Achachetam imam dharmyam sangramam na karishyasi tataswa dharmam kirtim cha hitva papam avapsyasi achachetam imam dharmyam sangramam na karishyati, sorry. Tataswa dharmam kirtim cha hitva papam avapsyasi. Ata, therefore, chet, if, twam, you, imam, this, dharmyam, as a religious duty, sangramam, fighting, na, do not, karishyasi, perform, tataha, then, swa dharmam, your religious duty, kirtim, reputation, cha, also, hitva, losing, paapam, sinful reaction, avapsyasi, will gain. Srila Prabhupada's translation. If, however, you do not perform this religious duty of fighting, then you will certainly incur sins for neglecting your duties, and thus lose your reputation as a fighter. Srila Prabhupada's purport. Okay. Arjuna was a famous fighter, and he attained fame by fighting many great demigods, including even Lord Shiva. After fighting and defeating Lord Shiva in the dress of a hunter, Arjuna pleased the Lord and received as a reward a weapon called Pasupata Astra. Everyone knew that he was a great warrior. Even Dronacharya gave him benedictions and awarded him the special weapon by which he could kill even his teacher. And Dronacharya was his teacher. So Prabhupada saying Dronacharya gave him the weapons to be able to kill himself. So he was credited with so many military certificates from many authorities, including his adopted father Indra, the heavenly king. Now that's also interesting because Indra was actually his biological father and Pandu was really his adopted father. But he was considered the son of Pandu. Officially, he was considered the son of Pandu and Indra more as his adopted father, so it's interesting. But if he abandoned the battle, not only would he neglect his specific duty as a Kshatriya, but he would lose all his fame and good name and thus prepare his royal road to hell. In other words, he would go to hell not by fighting, but by withdrawing from battle. Atachet tvam imam dharmyam samgramam na karishyasi tatasvadharmam kirtim cha hitva papam avapsyasi. If, however, you do not perform this religious duty of fighting, then you will certainly incur sins for neglecting your duties and thus lose your reputation as a fighter. So Arjuna had given an argument as to why he didn't want to fight. And one of his arguments was that he didn't want to incur sin, that he felt that fighting would be sinful and that he would be punished. And he was feeling it would be sinful because he would be killing or fighting against, trying to kill his teacher, Dronacharya, and his granduncle, Bhishma, who they called the grandfather, although he had never actually fathered any children, that he'd be fighting against his other relatives, his cousins, the sons of Dhritarashtra, and he felt that this was very sinful, to be fighting against those who had helped him. And generally, of course, that's true. To be trying to kill somebody who's helped you, an elder family member, is extremely sinful. But here Krishna's saying that this is your duty to fight, and if you don't do your duty, we have swadharmam. We have this very important word, swadharmam, your duty. Then you are going to have sins, and then you're going to go to hell. So this is one of the many instances where dharma, where what is righteous, what is the right thing to do, is not so clear and is going to change from one circumstance to another. So we have here something that's normally very sinful, in this case is pious. And what would normally be pious, in this case, is sinful. So first it's a good idea to try to define what we mean by sin. We have this word papam here. And that's a very useful thing to know, because according to the law of karma, if I do sin, I will suffer. And none of us like to suffer. All of us have had, I assume, some suffering in our life. Maybe we've gotten sick. Maybe we've been poor. Maybe people have criticized us, or we haven't had the work that we like, or something. You know, we've had some difficulty in our life, some kind of suffering, physical, mental, emotional, financial, some kind of suffering, maybe all of them, maybe all of them at once. One friend of mine recently told me that he was fired from a job that he had had for over 10 years, and he was fired, as far as he knew, he had done nothing wrong, and he was fired in a very emotionally devastating way, that he felt that the company and the people to whom he had given everything had turned against him. And soon after that, he got into a motorcycle accident and was severely injured and so forth. So he had, you know, emotional trouble and physical trouble, and probably because he got fired, financial trouble, all at the same time. So that's the result of sin, bad karma, right? Now we're all familiar with this concept. But if I do pious things, I get good karma. And if I do impious things, if I do sinful things, I get bad karma. And we feel like we have a pretty good idea of what that means. you know, we, okay, if I help out some poor person or some, you know, help somebody who's disadvantaged, then I get good karma, and if I try to hurt people, I get bad karma. You know, we have some general idea of what that means. But let's look really, what does it mean, sin and piety? Because it isn't always that clear. You know, as we said, what's pious in one situation can be sinful in another situation. It really isn't all that clear. So the way that I like to understand piety and sin is what's in harmony with truth. We have this word yoga, which means to link, and very connected to the word yukta, to link. To be linked with the Supreme, to be connected with the Supreme. What is in harmony with truth? I mean, if we just think about immediate reactions. So I have water in a cup here. And if I drink the water, that's good. Are you having a problem with my connection?
We were for a moment before, but we're not right now.
Okay, I can switch to another system.
It was only like for 10 seconds.
Okay, let me know if it happens again and I will switch to another system. That's what I was trying to set up in the beginning, because sometimes the connection here is unstable. So I have water in a cup. If I drink the water, that's good. If I try to eat the cup, that's bad. Right? If I try to eat the cup, I will probably chip my teeth, and if I were able to cut the cup into little pieces, it's a metal cup, and eat it. I mean, there is someone in the Guinness Book of World Records who ate an airplane bit by bit, but it's not in harmony with my body. My body is not designed to eat metal. Right? My body is designed to drink water. It's not designed to eat metal. And, you know, what's food depends on what kind of body you have. Right? The koala bears just eat eucalyptus leaves, for example, or panda bears or somebody. You know, that's what they eat. That's their food. But if we humans tried to live on that, we'd get extremely sick. So what's in harmony with reality? Another example I give all the time is we're in a room. I assume all of you are in some kind of a structure. And the structure has walls and windows and at least one door. So if I want to exit the room, if I exit through the window, especially if I'm not on the ground floor, I'll really get hurt. If I try to exit through the walls, I will most likely get bruised. And if I exit through the door, then I will be happy. And it's not that the windows or the walls have been designed to cause me pain. It's like that my metal cup is not designed to cause me pain. My metal cup is designed to hold the liquid, so they're not like spilling out of my fingers if I'm trying to hold the water in my hand. They have their use, but if I use something in a way that it's not meant to be used, then I will suffer. My daughter, when she was quite young, decided that she couldn't understand why we couldn't drink lying down. Of course, you can with a flexible straw. But she laid, I think she had apple juice in her cup, and she lay down on her bed and lying down tried to drink the apple juice, and of course it made a big mess. So if we use things in a way that they're not designed, if we use things out of harmony with truth, we suffer. And if we use things in harmony with truth, then we're happy. And I see that we can define sin and piety like that. And the absolute truth, Param Sattvam Dhimahi, we meditate on the absolute truth, is Krishna. So if I'm working in harmony with Krishna, and his, of course, the universe, the Vishwarup, is his body, as described throughout the Srimad Bhagavatam, the universe is his body, he is the soul of the universe, and if we function in the universe in harmony with the Lord's plan, then we are happy and everybody is happy, and if we function in a different way, we are unhappy and everybody, we also make other people unhappy. And as Srila Prabhupada writes, that we are cells in the universal body, and we know that in our own body, if a cell starts to act independently, if it starts to act for its own purposes out of harmony with the body, we call that cancer. Yes? And that, of course, will eventually kill the body, and then, of course, when the body dies, the cells will also die. So that's, to me, a very basic explanation of what is dharma and what is papa. what is righteousness and what is sin. Now, it becomes a little bit more complicated because there's a general dharma, we could say sanatan dharma, eternal dharma, which is jivera swarupaya krishnara nityadasha. We are all eternally servants of Krishna. We are all meant to serve Krishna. But that's kind of vague, you know, because like if we're going to take the example of the body, so my the cells in my eye have a different service to perform than the cells in my eyebrows or the cells in my forehead, the skin of my forehead, and the cells in my nose and the cells in my tongue. And they have different functions to perform. And if my tongue cells think that they're supposed to do brain function, that will also be a problem. You know, when we start off in the womb, we start off, our body starts off as one undifferentiated cell. And as the cells divide, they start differentiating into a heart, into a brain, into eyes, into so forth. And each of these categories has a different function to perform. So the dharma of a stomach cell is radically different from the dharma of a lung cell. They have different things that they do. And if a cell in the lung starts to secrete hydrochloric acid, that's going to cause severe injury. Whereas when the cells in the stomach secrete hydrochloric acid, that's their function, and then this body will be able to digest its food and so forth. So here we have the swadharmam, not just dharma, but we have two words. We have idam dharmyam and swadharmam. So swa means yours, to do your duty. This dharma is your duty to do. I personally don't have a duty to take up weapons and go to a battlefield, at least not in this lifetime. That's not. I doubt if I will have that duty before I leave this body. That's just not my swadharma. But it was Arjuna's swadharma. So there becomes this general that I have to serve Krishna. And then how? Then I have to use my nature. Now, this concept of using my nature, doing my own duty, is something that runs throughout the Bhagavad Gita and the Srimad Bhagavatam, indeed, all the Vedic literatures. That we have different duties, and these duties are divided up in a general way into what we call four varnas and four ashramas. So the four ashramas are what is my duty according primarily to age. That when, and this is not a foreign concept entirely, that when I'm very young, my duty is to study and to learn. So in most human cultures, through most of human history, children are expected to learn. Sometimes they're just expected to learn a trade, but they're expected to learn. That's their duty, is to study, to learn. And then when one hits youthful life, when one's body matures, then one's duty is to produce children and to produce wealth for society, to produce good population and to produce honest wealth. And this is done in the vast majority of human societies by marriage. So you make a commitment to a spouse because human babies are very helpless for a very long time. They do best if raised by more than one person. And so you make a commitment to the spouse that the biological parents of the child raise the child and then engage in a livelihood, engage in producing various kinds of wealth for society. And then once you hit around middle age, beginning of old age, in most societies there's some sort of retirement where, you know, you don't have, your children are grown up. Your children are grown up. Now they're entering into family life and you're getting to the point that it's hard to work 8 hours a day. It's hard physically, mentally to work 8 hours a day. And so you retire from work and you retire from family life. You retire from having children and you retire from making a living. And many people in many parts of the world, of course not now in COVID, but in general, people like to travel during that time. It's quite common that people retire and they travel. I remember when my father retired that he was always taking this cruise and that cruise, you know, and so forth. And then at the very end of life, when one gets very old, generally the body starts breaking down, not being able to function so well, and usually people become more reclusive and more constrained in their activities. and they prepare for death. So this is the biological life cycle of for most human beings, and there's various dharma or duty that goes along with that life cycle. So when you're young and you study, you also study the Vedas. You don't just study reading and writing and arithmetic and geography and history, but you also study the Vedas, and you study these under a teacher who is not just an expert in teaching and not just an expert in the subject matter, but who also trains you in spirituality, in sense control. And then in marriage, you don't just produce children and money, but you give in charity for the whole society, and you particularly fund yajñas. You fund sacrifices for society, and you maintain those who are going to school, and you maintain those who've retired. Right? So you're maintaining them so they don't have to earn a livelihood. And you're doing yajñas for the pleasure of the Lord. And then in retired life, the ashram system is you travel not just to Disneyland or the Panama Canal or something like that, but you travel to holy places. And you gradually detach yourself from home and family and money by traveling to holy places, sharing the wisdom that you have learned in life. And then at the very end of life, then you renounce everything and you die before dying. You become civilly dead. Prabhupada says it's like civil suicide, where you no longer have any responsibilities whatsoever for society, you don't really interact with society, and you prepare to leave this world. So those are very different duties. If someone, you know, when they're 20, if they just want to travel all over the place, and then they're irresponsible, right? At that time, they're supposed to get married. They're supposed to have a livelihood. They're supposed to maintain society, right? But if when you're 60, instead of traveling and taking up renunciation, if then you decide, well, now I want to marry, then that's irresponsible. So there's different duties for different ashrams, for different times of life. And those duties for the different times of life are very much tied to the natural biological life cycle. So it's using, and this is a very important point, the system of ashram dharma means you're using what's already the biological, physiological, psychological nature of different life stages in the service of the Lord. You're taking those natures and using it in harmony with the universe, in harmony with the Lord, for the pleasure of the Lord. You're taking something that's nature anyway. Right? You take something that's nature anyway, and you're connecting it. You're doing this yoga, you're doing this yukta, linking with the Lord. And then during the prime of life, let's say age 15 or 20 to 50, 60, while one is earning a livelihood, so then we have this varna dharma. So this, of course, Arjuna is dealing here with this varna dharma. He's a householder. He's a married man. And so he's later on, like we read about in the Bhagavatam, later on Arjuna becomes a renunciate. And he does give up this Kshatriya Dharma. We'll talk about that a little later. But anyway, here he's a grihastha. He's a householder. He's a married man. And his varna is a Kshatriya. Kshatriya means someone who runs the government. So here, the Lord, Chaturvarna Mayashrisam, Guna Karma Abhibhagashaha, that the Lord has divided all possible occupations into four main categories. Those who are in the field of ideas, those who are dealing with ideas, with knowledge, with religion, with truth and wisdom, those who are in government, who are dealing with righteousness and honor and justice and ethics and protection, those who are in the field of resources, who are generating all the wealth for society. So they're the ones who are taking the natural resources, the animals, the land, the water, the air, and they're turning it into usable wealth for society. And then you have those who are in the field of artistry, and they are making society function. They're the ones who, you know, make sure that we have running water and that the grass is cut and the garbage is taken out. They're making sure that society functions. And they're also making society beautiful. So when they fix the plumbing, they're also making society beautiful, that there's not puddles of water everywhere. They're cutting the grass so that everything doesn't look disheveled and so forth. So those, they're providing all of the beauty for society and all of the function for society. And all of the hundreds of thousands I don't know if there's millions, but at least hundreds of thousands of careers can be organized into one of these four categories. I mean, there's some overlap. There's people in the field of artistry who assist those in the field of ideas. There's those in the field of artistry that assist those in the field of government, those in the field of artistry who assist those in the field of resources, which means that those people have a little predilection for both of those fields, right? If you're going to be a clerk working in government, if you're working for a law firm, you would have some interest in the law, even though you're not a lawyer. You're just a clerk. You're just an assistant, right? And if you're an assistant in a big agribusiness, you're going to have some interest in agriculture. So the idea is that there are those, you know, there's some crossover, and then there are those in the field of ideas that specifically advise those in the field of government, and then there are those in the field of ideas that especially advise those in the field of resources, and those in the field of ideas that especially advise those in the field of artistry. So there may be some little bit of mix like that. But for each of these, there's a different dharma. And this is what we call swadharma. And what we are supposed, just like the brain cells have a particular dharma and the stomach cells have a particular dharma, so according to one's classification of occupation into one of these four categories, the dharma is different. So for those in the field of government who are supposed to bring justice to the society and ethics and morality, they need to punish wrongdoers. That's their dharma, which is what Arjuna is doing here, or what he's supposed to be doing. He's not doing it yet right now. He's kind of complaining about it. But that's their job, and that isn't really the job of anybody else. So it isn't really the job of college professors, you know, to punish the wrongdoers. It isn't really the job of, you know, the farmer or the person who owns a mine or, you know, the person who runs a clothing business. It's not the job of the person who's making pots or the person who's fixing your plumbing. You know, nowadays people sometimes think, you know, it's everyone's job to punish wrongdoers. Well, that's not a fact. That's specifically the job of the government. Right? Or somebody was saying to me the other day, you know, social media is censoring people. And I said, social media can't censor people. Censorship means it's done by the government. I said, if some social media is restricting speech, that's not the government restricting speech. I said, just like I could restrict speech in my home. Or, you know, if I had some gathering, let's say I was running a mall and I have some public area in the mall, it's still, I own the mall and I can restrict what speech is discussed in the mall. So that's quite different from a government. And this person was arguing with me and saying, no, you know, Facebook is the government. And I said, no, it's not. I said, the government make sure that everyone has clean drinking water, make sure that everyone has education, make sure there's good roads, that there's provision for medical care, that there's provision for defense against, foreign and domestic enemies. That's the job of government. and you can't say that a social media site is a government. And so there's different jobs. You know, there's different jobs according to what function they're playing in society. Like for those in the field of resources, the Vaishyas, they're supposed to generate wealth. But those in government, they don't generate wealth. They collect wealth and then they redistribute it. And those in the field of ideas on generally a much smaller scale, they collect wealth and they redistribute it. But they're not generating wealth. Right? So those in the field of ideas can be very forgiving because they're not supposed to be punishing wrongdoers. But those in the field of government, if they're that forgiving, we have a problem. Those in the field of resources have to be very profit-minded, because if they're not making a profit, then they can't supply wealth to the rest of society. Those in the field of resources have the adage, put your own oxygen mask on first, like when you're on a plane. If anybody can remember what it was like to be on a plane, and you're told to put your own oxygen mask on first. So those who are vicious, they have to make sure that they're making a living. Otherwise, what they do is not sustainable. Right? If they just give everything away, then their business is not sustainable. It will go bankrupt. Right? But the kshatriyas, those in government, they have the opposite thing. They run into danger. We have this word avimanyu, Abhi means toward, Manyu means danger. They go towards danger. You can think of the firefighters. They run, and everybody else is running out of the burning house. They're running into the burning house. So those in the field of government, they go towards danger. Whereas those in the other four, the other three varnas, they go away from danger. They protect themselves. And particularly the Vaishyas have to make sure that they protect their own wealth in order to serve society. So it's quite a different mentality. It's quite a different mentality. And those who are in the field of artistry, who are Shudras, they tend to be very satisfied. They tend not to want to have a lot of money or fame. I hear Krishna's talking about fame, kirti. They don't really care. The same with those in the field of ideas. They really just don't care. Those in the field of ideas, the brahmanas, and those in the field of artistry, the shudras, they don't usually really care about fame. But those in government, they have to care about fame. They have to, actually. Because in order to serve the people, the kshatriyas have to have some degree of patriotism, an idea of loyalty to the country, which actually feels very uncomfortable to those in the field of ideas. They're like, why do we, you know... Yeah, they're interested in truth. They're not so much interested in loyalty. Right? So there's different things for the different fields, and they're incompatible with each other. Like many times people say, you should put people ahead of projects. Well, that's true for those in the field of government. For those in the field of government, they're supposed to serve people. And they're always supposed to put people ahead of projects. But those in the field of resources, they better put projects ahead of people. Because if they just think about caring for all the people, then their project, their business, will fail. And then they won't be able to take care of anyone. So what's dharma in one for one varna is adharma, or papa, for another varna. Right? I hope that makes sense to everybody. I mean, even we can think about, say, an inspector. Let's say somebody is a building inspector. So for a building inspector, you want a person who's hypercritical and notices every possible mistake. I mean, you want that in a building inspector or, you know, a bridge inspector. You don't want a building inspector who's like, oh, you know, however you want to do it, it's fine. You know, it's not something that you want. Now, you might like that, you know, you might not want to have a teacher to be hypercritical, but you want an inspector to be hypercritical, right? A teacher, you want to have some encouragement, but you don't want the inspector to be just encouraging. You want the inspector to just be fault-finding and nothing else. So what's dharma for one person is adharma, is papa for another. And, you know, even the building inspector, hopefully he doesn't go home and find fault with everything his wife or children do. You know, like the wife has to say, turn off your building inspection now, you're home. You know, when I used to teach my young children, sometimes my husband would say, you're home now, you know, we're not all five-year-olds. So, you know, what's sinful, even for one person, in different situations may change. And then it's also at different times, even for in the same varna, right, and the same person, just like we have here Arjuna. That may be changing. So at some time he's respecting Dronacharya. Oh, Dronacharya, you're my teacher. What can I learn from you? And then now he's expected to fight with Dronacharya. So that may also change. Okay, so the first item of dharma, we've talked for quite a long time about this, but it's very important, is to use our particular nature in the service of the Lord. Now, although this idea is repeated often throughout the Shastra, I do know of many devotees who don't really accept this idea. They say that real love and real surrender is that anybody should be prepared to do anything that's needed. They basically act as if all the cells in the body are still back in the womb as undifferentiated, and that if you ask a stomach cell, you know, well, if you really love the body, you should be able to act as a brain cell. But that, it just doesn't work. It's not that if we really love Prabhupada, if we really love Krishna, that we're going to do something that's opposite to our nature or opposed to our nature. It doesn't work. And Krishna says twice in the Bhagavad Gita that it doesn't work. And he says if we try to do that, if we try to do someone else's work perfectly, when it's not our nature, then that work will become a bhayavaha, which means a vehicle of fear. Okay, so that's the first idea of dharma, is we have to know what is my nature, and then to do that for Krishna. Now, the other thing that's being mentioned here is Arjuna's gifts. So Arjuna fought with Lord Shiva, and he got this gift of the Pasupata Astra. Pasupata Astra. Pasu means an animal, and Astra means a weapon. So he got this special mystic weapon from Lord Shiva. Vaishnavayata Shambhu, the greatest of the Vaishnavas, gave him this special mystical weapon. And then he got from Dronacharya. Dronacharya gave him benedictions and weapons that were so... Dronacharya was his teacher, his martial teacher, his military teacher. And Dronacharya gave him such incredible blessings and weapons that Arjuna could even kill Dronacharya with him. In other words, the teacher, Dronacharya, who was a brahmana in the field of ideas, was so liberal that he was willing to give his students the means to surpass him. And this is the general mood of teachers, that teachers wish their students to be able to surpass them. Now, a government, talking about different dharmas by different natures, a government wouldn't do that. A government isn't going to give other governments weapons to defeat them. Right? The Americans, the American government, they wouldn't sell another government the means to defeat American weapons. That would be really foolish. That would be a dereliction of duty. But if you're a teacher, you want your students to surpass you, whatever you're teaching. That's the mood of a teacher, this non-envious mood of a teacher. So anyway, Arjuna had these blessings. He had these gifts. So another part of dharma is to use the gifts that we've been given. And it's related to the concept of nature, but it kind of takes it beyond that. Srila Prabhupada often uses the word miser or miserly, kripana. And he says this idea of being a miser, it's the opposite of a devotee. And what does a miser do? You know, I think the typical idea of a miser is Ebenezer Scrooge from Charles Dickens' A Christmas Carol, where Ebenezer Scrooge is very rich, but he keeps all of his money and just basically looks at it. He doesn't even use the money for his own happiness, and he doesn't give the money to his workers, even if they're very poor and very much in need. So he's keeping the money. You know, the person who's so fearful that they're just looking at their wealth as a kind of security, right? They even call that, when you invest your money, securities. They're just keeping their wealth as a kind of security, but they're not using it. And of course, everyone should have some savings. That is a religious principle, that especially those who are family people, who are married, should have some savings. I mean, anyone who has fixed expenses should definitely have some savings. For emergencies. Prabhupada talks about how in traditional society, in a family, that they kept their wealth in things that they could also use. So they would have utensils made out of real silver, which is why we call it silverware, and they would have pots made out of metals that would last a long time. I know one family that told me their wealth was in their furniture. They had a whole home full of beautiful antique furniture. So they're using the furniture, they're using the silverware, they're using the jewelry, but in need they could sell it. And of course we all know about instances where there's wars and where the paper money becomes useless and people are selling, you know, their jewelry, their furniture and things like this. So traditional societies, the way they had savings was not just a bunch of gold that was, you know, buried in the ground, but gold that was jewelry that they were wearing. Right, silver that was utensils that they were using, furniture that they were using. And so they were making use, or, you know, if you invest in a home and you're living in the home and yet you can sell it and so forth. So we're not saying that you shouldn't have any savings. It's not what we're saying. But we're saying that our wealth should be not hoarded without being spent on something worthwhile. Money has no use, wealth has no use without being spent. And wealth is not just cash. You know, there's six kinds of wealth that are explained, six kinds of prosperity that are explained in the Shastra. One can have a wealth of beauty. That can mean your own physical beauty. It can mean you have artwork and music and gardens and so forth. It also can mean charisma, Shri. Then there's Virya. Virya means potency. It means sexual potency, fertility. It also means strength and health. Right? Then there's Gyan. One can have a wealth of knowledge. And there's Yasha, which is very related to today's verse. One can have a wealth of fame. Yasha means especially... Yasha is the child of Kirti and Dharma in the Bhagavatam. Kirti means you talk about someone, and Dharma means for good reason. And the wealth of Yasha, you're famous, means you must have a community. Maybe you have a big family, you have a big community, you're surrounded by something like that. Then we have Vairagya. Vairagya is freedom, autonomy, renunciation. That's another kind of prosperity. And then we have Aishwarya, which Prabhupada often defines just as wealth, but it's related to the word Ishwara. So this is where you have a wealth of leadership, where people listen to you, people follow what you say. Maybe not everybody, but most of us would like to have other people listen to what we say. So these are the six kinds of wealth, and none of these kinds of wealth is supposed to be hoarded. They're supposed to be distributed. They're supposed to be used. Yes. So this is, here Arjuna is being given blessings of wealth, these mystic weapons, these blessings. And his fame is also a kind of gift. He has a kirtan. So people are, it was related to the word kirtan, people are praising him, people are talking about him. And he's supposed to use that for the glory of the Lord. He's not supposed to hoard it. He's not supposed to throw it away. You know how we feel when we give someone a gift, we want them to use it. Right? Like many years ago when my husband and I entered into the renounced order of Vanaprastha, so I had some jewelry which I gave away, and I gave one devotee these earrings that I'd gotten from my mother, and they were solid gold with lapis lazuli. They were very beautiful. And a year or so later when I was visiting her, I saw these valuable and beautiful earrings on the floor mixed with her children's toys and covered in dust. So I didn't like that. I didn't like seeing the gift that I gave for her neglected. So Krishna feels like that too, and his devotees like Lord Shiva or like Dronacharya, they also feel like that, that if they give gifts to someone, they want them used in the service of the Lord. So that is also part of our swadharma, that we see what gifts have I been given. Prabhupada says everyone has some extraordinary talent, and to use that talent in the service of the Lord is successful life. So we have our general dharma, according to our age, our marital status, according to our inclinations for livelihood. We have that. We have those big categories of dharma. And then we have our particular talents, our particular gifts, our particular types of prosperity. And we're meant to, again, use that in the service of the Lord. We're meant to share that, and that's our dharma. And each of us individually has particular gifts that we're meant to share. And, you know, it's hard in this world. Arjuna's finding it's difficult. And Arjuna's also thinking, you know, just forget about everything and let me just retire now and go to the forest and just beg and, you know, forget, it's too much trouble. But if we don't use these things, then that's considered sinful. That's considered sinful. Now, another way that we do our proper dharma, and this is very crucial, and we hinted at this earlier, is being able to distinguish between what's a lower dharma and what's a higher dharma. Now, all dharma, dharmam tu saksha bhagavat pranitam, all dharma, all rules, all righteousness come from God. So every level of dharma, every level of what's good, it all comes from God. It's all in harmony with God. However, as we were saying, sometimes a certain thing is bad and another time it's good. You know, you can say generally you should respect your elders. Generally you should respect those who've taught you and who've helped you. And you shouldn't fight against them and kill them. but under certain circumstances, you would fight against them. So in some cases,
it's higher to respect your elders, as Prabhupada says in the Bhagavad Gita purport, that the system is you don't even verbally fight with your superiors. And then in some cases, a higher principle is to physically fight with them. And what's higher and lower is not always the same. It may change at different times. I'm thinking of an example of Raghunath Das Goswami. So Raghunath Das Goswami wanted to join Sri Chaitanya Mahaprabhu, and his parents and his uncle and aunt, they were all devotees of Chaitanya Mahaprabhu. They were facilitating Haridas Thakur and so forth. But Raghunath Das Goswami wanted to leave everything and become a renunciate with Chaitanya Mahaprabhu, and his parents were opposed to that. So they kept physically stopping him. They were physically restraining him from going to see Lord Chaitanya. And Sri Chaitanya Mahaprabhu, when he met Raghunath Das Goswami, he said, "Don't be a crazy fellow." He said, "Go home and pretend that you're really into your family and the business and everything. And when it's time, you can come to me." So we could say, as a general principle, Sarva Dharmam Prachaja Mame Kam Sharanam Vraja Aham Tvam Sarva Pape Vyo Mokshi Shami Masuja. We could say, as a general principle, giving up considerations of business and family and social obligations and just surrendering to Krishna is a higher principle. However, when the Lord Himself says, "Hey, stay with your family right now and make a show of being a normal person until it's the right time," then that's the higher principle. So it's not so easy to tell. You know, I could look at my life and say, well, this is definitely a higher principle. But maybe for someone else's life, my higher principle is their lower principle. It's really not that easy to discern what is dharma for me and what is dharma for somebody else. And being able to discern what is my dharma in any particular instance, well, if it's so difficult, how am I going to keep from engaging in sin? I mean, even Arjuna is having a hard time figuring this out. He's picking the lower dharma as the higher dharma and the higher dharma as the lower dharma. So he's ready to give up the higher dharma for the lower dharma, and he's making a mistake. And he's Arjuna. I mean, he's really qualified. So how am I going to figure it out? Well, we have here kind of an evidence procedure where Krishna is talking here about what is the result. You know, which Prabhupada talks about in the purport, preparing the royal road to hell. One of the very easy subjective ways is we say judge by the result. So I know a devotee whose husband went through some difficulty, and many people were advising her to divorce him and leave him. And she said whenever she thought about divorcing him, she immediately felt angry, she felt an anxiety, and whenever she felt, you know, I should be loyal to him and stick with him through this difficulty and we'll get out the other side, she felt happy and peaceful. And you may say that's very subjective. We can fool ourselves and so forth. But it is an evidence procedure. When we're doing something that's in opposition to the Lord and in opposition to the universe, it will fill us with anxiety. And Arjuna is filled with anxiety. Right? His throat is drying up. His bow Gandiva is slipping from his hand. Prabhupada said he's also crying. If something absolutely fills me with anxiety, that is, it's possible. We can't use that entirely because people are in different modes and different things may put them in anxiety. One person may feel happy and energized by committing serial murder, you know. But generally, if something fills us with fear and anger and anxiety, it's probably sinful. Just like if I try to get out of the room and I bang my head, I probably didn't go through the door. Now, how do I know that I did dharma? I was able to walk out the door. Prabhupada says if you're not joyful, you can't be making any advancement. One of the symptoms, susukam kartamavyam, one of the symptoms that I'm in dharma is that I'm going to feel happy. I'm going to feel peaceful. Shantimam, what is it? Yatvamam shantimichati. We'll feel peaceful. We'll feel happy. It's not, as we say, rocket science. Now, that's not all. We have to look at the other things we looked at. What's my nature? Am I using it in the service of the Lord? What are my gifts? Am I using it in the service of the Lord? What do the scriptures say? But the scriptures are going to give different instructions because they're going to be applied differently in different places. You know, what does my guru say? What do the sami persons say? And then how do I feel? Pratyaksha vagamam dharmam. Prabhupada uses that to say, and refers to the 11th canto, you know, how do you know you're eating? You know, unless we have some sort of disease, physical or psychological disease, we know when we're hungry and we know when we're full. Prabhupada says you don't need a certificate from others. Savaipum sampuro dharma yato bhaktir hoktajaya hoitukiya pratita yadatma supersedati. Yadatma supersedati. If we're doing the highest dharma, we will feel satisfied and happy. If we're not feeling satisfied and happy, we are probably not doing the highest dharma. We're doing a lower dharma. Or we're not doing dharma at all. A devotee recently I was dealing with, he was so upset about something going on in the kirtans, and this is not the way Prabhupada wanted to do it. And he talked to me about it, and I said, I think you're wrong. I just give it up, forget about it, it's not important. He talked to other people, and they all told him, everybody told him the same thing. It's not important, don't worry about it. Let it go, it's not important. Or you're just wrong. It's not Prabhupada's instructions. And finally his wife said, you know, you have to listen to him because he's getting sick worrying about this. And I'm thinking, if you're getting sick worrying about this, it's a good sign that you shouldn't be worrying about it. It's a good sign that you should let it go if it's making you sick. Yeah? So Arjuna had this strong evidence procedure that when he was thinking, I'm not supposed to fight. I'm not supposed to fight against these people, my relatives, my seniors. This will happen, that will happen, the other happened. And it physically, he started falling apart. His physiology responded negatively. Yeah, I had this experience once. I was in a very scary situation and I had these kind of symptoms that Arjuna was exhibiting. You know, it's a lack of surrender. It's a lack of connection. Yeah. And Raghunath Das Goswami talks about this in his Manashiksha in verse 6. How if we think we're doing the right thing, if we think, yes, I'm acting dharmically, but we're actually not. We're actually acting just out of ego or pride, or that it's like taking a bath and burning donkey urine. Well, you think you're getting clean because it's a liquid, but donkey urine is burning. It's very acidic. I mean, it stinks too, but he talks about it burning, taking a bath in donkey urine. And so your mind is disturbed and burning. I had one devotee tell me, you know, I'm like a walking volcano. And I thought, well, that means you're taking a bath in donkey urine. So if we think that something is our dharma and we think something is service, but it's burning us, then we can understand that we're doing something that's sin and we're thinking that is dharma. And then what's the result? If we do dharma, then we're happy in this life, we're prosperous in this life. At the time of death, if it's ordinary dharma, we go to the heavenly planets. If it's transcendent sanatana dharma, we go to the spiritual world. And as Prabhupada said here, that if we do sinful activities, we will have the royal road to hell. In other words, we'll easily go to hell. So we'll be miserable in this life, and then next life we'll suffer in so many ways. So we have time for questions and discussions. I can't remember exactly what time everything is supposed to end.
We wrap up around 7, so there's a little time.
Okay.
I have a question, if it's okay.
Yeah.
The proof is in the pudding, and the proof of doing the right thing for Krishna is experiencing Krishna consciousness. Symptomatic of Krishna consciousness is bliss, not this anxiety. So this is, so you were talking about this a lot.
Yes.
So I wanted to ask you if you can perhaps distinguish that way of evaluating whether what you're doing is dharmic or adharmic, you know, right or wrong for you. For example, I'll give two examples of something that might seem similar, but I think is really a different sort of with different ways of evaluating right and wrong, good or bad, for these two different examples. Okay, so one would be, I'm not going to give the anecdote of the story because I don't remember it quite right. But so I guess there's something about the teacher of spirituality supposedly is always peaceful, shanti, 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 never, but Prabhupada, you know, sometimes he would be sharp and tough and not just smile no matter what happened. And so some people would criticize someone like Prabhupada for being like that. So the reason that I bring this up is one, you're not saying, my understanding is you're not saying, so when Prabhupada's being, you know, tough about something, that's the same as being anxious, which means not Krishna conscious. So I'm just asking if you can distinguish.
Well, let's look at Arjuna. Arjuna is going out with his bow and arrow and killing people. That's pretty tough. But he's feeling that he's in the right place, doing what he's meant to be doing. He feels happy and peaceful and satisfied. But, you know, if you're the teacher, Prabhupada is the teacher, you had better correct your students sometimes. That's your dharma. You can't just say, oh, did you get that wrong? It's okay. You know, then nobody was ever going to learn anything. So you may sometimes have to get heavy. I had a student that came to me, 11 years old, and she had had a really bad background, really difficult life. Her mother had died when she was 2, and she went to boarding schools where she was physically mistreated and where she hadn't learned very much. She came to me at 11 and she could barely read. She was very angry. She had a lot of anger. And I just wasn't getting through to her at all. I mean, we just weren't making any progress. And she would be very, as I say in the UK, cheeky, but like snarky and insolent. She was very insolent. And she was very angry. And one day I just got fed up with her. And I had a yardstick, you know, big ruler. And I went and I slammed it on her desk. And it broke. I said, you know, you've got to try to do the work. And I slammed this ruler on her desk and it splintered. And after that, she changed. And when I asked her about it some time later, I said, why? And she said, I finally understood that you actually cared about me. That I mattered to you. She said, you were the first person that ever cared about me in my life. Anybody else just let me just learn nothing and go nowhere. You know, and evidently I had to get emotional. You know, I remember after I broke the ruler, I felt kind of embarrassed. I'm like, oops, you know, I think I kind of got too emotional. But that was what was required at the moment. So we're not saying that we should just be insipid. We're not saying that if we're in Krishna consciousness, we're just dull, you know, impersonalist. Hello, I am blissful. You know, that's... But real bliss is a range of emotions. It's certainly a range of emotions. But that's very different from feeling, you know, guilt, shame, anger. You know, what does Krishna say? Lust, anger, greed. Kama, krodha, stida, lobha, tasmade, tvatayam, tajet. So, not that kind of stuff. Vengeance. It's nasty. Don't we all know how that feels? You know, when we're just like something's eating us inside. Yeah? That means we're in tamagun or rajagun. We're not connected. Now that can't be our only evidence procedure. We also have to look at what is my nature, you know? What is my nature in the ashrams? What is my nature in the varnas? What gifts has the Lord given me? What are the directions in the scripture? What's the directions from Guru? Otherwise, someone can say, well, I feel happy when I'm shooting heroin. You know, I mean, you're going to end up with that kind of garbage. So you have to look at the other things. But that is also included. How I feel is not nothing. It's not irrelevant. If I think I have all my ducks in a row, I think I'm using my nature in Krishna's service, I'm using my gifts in Krishna's service, I'm following the Shastra, but I'm miserable, then it's adharmic. And that's exactly what happened to Arjuna. He thought, I'm doing everything right. I'm caring about the women whose husbands and brothers and fathers and sons are going to die. I'm caring about my elders. I'm caring about the family tradition. I'm doing everything right. I am dharmic. But Krishna, why am I miserable? Why am I, if I'm doing everything right, why am I miserable? And then the answer is, because you're not doing everything right. You're choosing a lower dharma over a higher dharma. So that can't be the only evidence procedure, but it's got to be there. Well, we say necessary but not sufficient. You know, if you're going to bake bread or cake or something, there has to be some sort of liquid, water, milk, whey. But that's not sufficient. You can't say, well, I'm just going to have, you know, a cup of water and that's going to be a bread. But you have to have some kind of liquid. Does that make sense?
Yeah, I think your elaboration and explanation helped explain things further and really nicely. So that's a great supplement to what you had already said. Thank you.
Thank you, and nice to see you, by the way. Really a pleasure. Where are you now, by the way, geographically?
That's our honor. We're in Manhattan.
Oh.
In New York.
Yeah. Oh, cool. My home.
That's yeah, same. I was born in this life and raised as a devotee, you could say.
Uh-huh. Yeah, I was born and raised in Manhattan.
All right,
another question. Yes, Andrea.
Hi, yes, thank you very much. I have a question. When the topics that you brought up made me think of an interaction that I had today with a young woman. She was sharing with me. She lives in Germany, and she's not native born a German. Her parents were immigrants, and she's dealing with a lot of fear, anger, and uncertainty because of the rise of neo-Nazis and far-right kind of things in Germany, and she's having to deal with people of her age and other people of her community, like, being killed and harassed and all these things that are happening, which, you know, I wasn't aware. So we were just talking about that, and I just, it's not just her, it's when I'm talking to sometimes other young people that are very angry and afraid that those in government or those, the police, those that are supposed to protect them, that are supposed to care, and that's why I really appreciated your description of it, right? Those that are supposed to be trusted to act correctly, when they do not act correctly, how do the rest of us deal with that? And then the second part of that is, like, how do I help the young people that I'm talking to as much as I can in terms of dealing with those emotions and the things that are coming up for them? So that's, hopefully it's not too much.
Okay, well, that was a lot. The Vedic scriptures give instructions for how to have a sane and stable society as a whole. So if the majority of people do their individual dharma properly, then society as a whole will function well. And everybody will be taken care of because everybody will be doing their proper duty. As Ravindra Prabhu said, they didn't think so much about rights, they thought about responsibilities. And if everybody fulfills their responsibilities, then everyone's rights are automatically taken care of. Unfortunately, at the present time, people don't even understand this concept of how to work dharmically. It's not something that's being taught. People don't even understand it from a theoretical point of view. The fact that I have a nature and I have gifts and I have blessings that are meant to be used in the service of the whole, that are meant to be used in the service of, you know, if you want to think of the universe as the body of God, or you want to think of God as the Brahman or Paramatma, or you want to think of God as the Supreme Personality of Godhead. But they're not being taught this. I mean, frankly, even a lot of religions don't teach this very clearly. You know, that we have our gifts and our talents and our nature, and we're supposed to use that for the glory of God. I mean, it's there in the Bible, but, you know, it's not necessarily being taught very clearly. So because of that, I may be trying to live these principles in a society that as a whole is not living these principles. Fortunately, we can each achieve success in bhakti even if we're the only one. We don't need a perfect society in order to achieve our own harmony with the universe. I mean, somebody might have lung cancer, but, you know, their stomach is still working. So we have the capacity as individuals. Society as a whole won't be as nice. That's true. But as an individual level, we can find full peace and satisfaction and harmony in connection with Krishna. Now, we do have, as part of the mission of the International Society for Krishna Consciousness, to try to bring peace and prosperity as far as we are able to the world. My own personal conviction is that this can be done, that our main bridge to doing that, we have this word we use in this kind of about bridge preaching. My own personal conviction is that our main bridge preaching is through Varna Dharma. That to teach people how to link their careers with the satisfaction of God. Because pretty much everybody has to have a career, and pretty much everybody wants to be happy in their career. Most people don't want to be miserable at what they do to earn a livelihood. Most people would like to enjoy their work. Most people would like their work to bring them prosperity. I don't know, maybe some people want to hate their work, so that's why I'm saying mostly. Maybe there's someone out there, I want to hate my work. I don't want to like what I do. I don't know. Some people are weird. But let's just say generally people would like to enjoy what they do and they'd like to be satisfied at what they do, and most people want to have meaning in their life, and most people want to feel that whatever they're doing in the world is some unique contribution that only they can make. So that's the whole, not the whole, but that's a big chunk of the principles of Varna Dharma. And if you're doing Varna Dharma properly, you're going to have some regular times of connecting with the Lord, and you're going to have to dedicate your work to the Lord. So it naturally leads into, it's a natural bridge in the Shastra, it's a natural Shastric bridge to bhakti, which is, of course, above these considerations of Varna Dharma or Ashram Dharma. But it's a natural bridge that people can go from, I'm doing my part for who I am, for the service of the Lord, to wait a minute, you know, what is my ultimate relationship with the Lord beyond this body, beyond this world, beyond this thing. And so we're trying to do that. We're trying to give people direct bhakti in the Bhagavad Gita and the Bhagavatam and Prasadam and deity worship, and we're also trying to give them a blueprint for a society in general. So we're working on that, and all of us should try to do our little bit, whatever it may be, to further this mission of Srila Prabhupada, to further this mission of Lord Chaitanya. Then how to deal with emotions. So that's a very big topic, and how to deal with emotions when things in the world aren't what we would like them to be. So first of all, everybody has things in the world that are not what they would like them to be. That's the main frustration with our trying to be God when we're not. And, you know, there's someone else in control and that person isn't me and I don't agree with the way that person is running things. That's our essential rebellion. That's our essential problem. And so we don't like things that happen with our body. We don't like things that happen with our mind. We don't like things that other people do. We don't like things that other people say, or things that they don't do or that they don't say or whatever. We don't like the weather. We don't like, you know, so many things we don't like and we think it's wrong and it should be fixed. And if only I was in charge and everything would be perfect, which is, of course, a bunch of nonsense. But we're thinking like that. You know, we're thinking, I know what's best for me. I know what's best for the world. I know what's best for my brother and sister and my mother and my father and my daughter and my son and my neighbor. And I know what's best for everybody. And so if only I could be God, then I would make everything lovely. And we feel very frustrated because we're not God and we can't do things the way that we would like to do them. So this is a general problem for everyone. It doesn't matter whether I'm not downplaying neo-Nazis and evil people. But even if you didn't have any neo-Nazis and even if you didn't have any evil people, you'd get upset with your neighbor who is whistling at 1 a.m. when they walk their dog or something. You know, there'd always be something that we would feel that if only this person wouldn't do that, then I'd be happy. And if only this person did do that, then I'd be happy. That's always going to be there. So what do the Shastras say to deal with emotions in this world, to deal with these thoughts and these emotions, is non-attachment. Nasochitina kanchati. Ichidvesha. No desire, no hatred. And this is very nicely explained here in the second chapter of the Bhagavad Gita, where Krishna says that if we contemplate this or that, I need to get this, or I need to not get this, you know, I need all the neo-Nazis to be imprisoned and executed, or, you know, I need their whatever. I need everybody to get 3 tomatoes a day, or whatever it is, you know, I have to get this, or I have to not have that. When we're attached to having this or not having this, or we hate having this, or we hate not having this, whatever it may be, fill in the blank. When we have this attachment and hatred, then we're going to be under the sway of these emotions and thoughts. Instead, we practice detachment. Krishna says, like rivers flowing into the ocean that's always being filled but is ever still. Oh, there's anger coming through this body. Okay, that's interesting. Ah, that's part of Krishna's energy. It's meant to get my body ready to fight if there was an enemy. Huh, interesting. All right. I'm not gonna get into it. And I'm not going to try to destroy it. It's not mine. Just watch it. And then it goes. One who does not hate illumination, attachment or delusion when they appear, nor long for them when they disappear, knowing that the modes alone are active. So, not trying to grasp illumination, attachment, or delusion, not hating illumination, attachment, or delusion. They come, they go. It's just the modes, it's just this body. It's not my body, it's not my modes, it's not my thoughts, it's not my feelings. Not mine. just Krishna's energies. You know, we walk down a busy street in New York, somebody's having an argument. We just walk around them, you know. We try to figure out what they're arguing about. Are they right? Are they wrong? Are they right to argue? Are they wrong to argue? What side am I going to take? We just walk around them. And same thing with, you know, our thoughts and they're not our thoughts, actually. The thoughts that go through the mind, the feelings that go through the body, the desires that go through the body, then none of them are mine. Just Krishna's energy. And they're designed for, you know, preservation of biological life. So they're loving. They're perfect, but they're not mine. They're not mine to enjoy and justify my enjoyment of them. You can enjoy anger and fear, by the way, and you can enjoy ghastliness, or you can try to. They're rasas. So it's not for me to enjoy the anger, it's not for me to enjoy the ghastliness, it's not for me to enjoy the fear, and it's not for me to hate them either. It's not for me to grasp them by holding them, and it's not for me to grasp them by pushing them away. It's not for me to grasp them, it's for me to say, oh, they're going through. You walk down the street in New York, you're going to see beautiful people, you're going to see ugly people, you're going to see skinny people, you're going to see fat people, you're going to see light-skinned people, you're going to see dark-skinned people, you're going to see old people, you're going to see young people, you're going to see dogs, you're going to see so many things. None of them are yours. You're going to see happy people, you're going to see sad people, you're going to see arguing people. Our thoughts it's not our thoughts, the thoughts and the feelings and the desires that pass through this body and the mind are just like all these different people and animals that we pass through walking down the street. Now, every spiritual tradition teaches this detachment from thoughts, feelings, and desires. In bhakti, we have the advantage that we can start to awaken our real thoughts and feelings and desires. We, the soul, not the thoughts, feelings, and desires of the body and the mind, which have nothing to do with us, but the thoughts, feelings, and desires of the soul, which are all about Krishna. So I don't want to just be the detached observer of the thoughts, feelings, and desires that pass through this body and mind, which is very hard to do if I don't have bhakti, but I become the observer of the thoughts, feelings, and desires passing through this body and mind because I'm cultivating the thoughts, feelings, and desires in relationship to Krishna. Now, if I'm walking down the street past the happy people and the arguing people and the beautiful, attractive people and the ugly, repulsive people and so forth, and I'm just trying to be detached, okay. But if I'm walking with a friend, I'm walking with someone I love, and I'm having a conversation with this person that I love and I love to be with, it's a whole lot easier to be detached from all these other people and animals that I'm walking by in the street. So if I'm absorbed in Krishna, it's much easier for me to just pay no attention to the thoughts, feelings, and desires that go through the body. I might note them. Oh, look, there's lust going through my body. Look at that. Interesting. Okay. Oh, there's greed going through my body. There's envy going through my body and mind. Haha, interesting. Okay, Hare Krishna. A lot easier if I'm absorbed in Krishna than if I'm just trying to do that impersonally. All right, I think that we should end here. Yes?
Unless I noticed Christina had a question. If there's no time, Irmala, then we can...
Well, we have 3 minutes, so if it's a very short question, not a double-barreled, complicated question like that last one was, which was a fantastic, incredible question. It's just that I wouldn't have time to answer another one like that.
I'll make it quick. Hi, Krishna.
Hi, Krishna.
Devadasya, thank you so much for your insight. It was very good. As you were just speaking, I was thinking about this quote I read from Bhaktivedanta Swami that said, you know, when you squeeze an orange,
yes,
what comes out? Orange juice, right?
Yes,
so, like,
right.
if we're getting agitated, it's because there's like something in us that we need to work.
And then I was thinking,
you know, like these anarthas that we have from like accumulated lifetimes of incarnations. What is one way, one active way we could work on these things that come out of us? You know, I know that the bhakti process, supposed to naturally do it, chanting the Maha Mantra will eventually get all the anarthas out. But what is another way we could actively...
No, I don't think you want another way. I think what you're really asking, because that's not my business to teach you another way. Teach me something other than bhakti, Urmila. So I don't think that's quite my job description. But I think what you're really asking is not that. You phrased it that way.
I don't think that's what you meant. Another way from bhakti.
I think what you meant is in what aspect, how can we cooperate with this bhakti process? How can we better cooperate with the bhakti process? So it's very interesting that you asked this, and now I have 1 minute. And this isn't a 1 minute answer. I will do my best. So When Krishna says in 264, so in 262 and 263, Krishna's giving the, you know, you get attached, and then you get lusty, and then you get angry, and then you get bewildered, and blah, 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 blah. And then 264, he says, be free from attachment and aversion. That's a mental discipline. Regulate your senses. That's a physical discipline. Bhagavad Prasadam, you will get the Lord's mercy. By Bhagavad Prasadam, I don't understand that Krishna is saying in 264 you're going to get samosas and burfi. I understand what he's saying is you'll get God's grace. You'll get help. Now, I talked about, in answer to Andrea's question, how to do that with thoughts, desires, and emotions that arise in the moment. But what you're talking about, what Bhaktivedanta Swami said, is thoughts, feelings, and emotions that we didn't deal with properly in the moment in the past. So in the past, in this life, or in the past in other lifetimes, or wherever in the past, when these thoughts, feelings, and desires were coming to our body and to the body and mind, instead of letting them flow through us and being an observer, and instead focusing on Krishna, we try to enjoy them or we repress them. And therefore, when some difficult situation comes up, those old things surface. And Bhaktivedanta Swami's analogy is very apt. You know, it's like if I'm holding a cup of water and you bump into me, I will spill water. If I'm holding a cup of orange juice and you bump into me, I will spill orange juice. Right? So when there's difficult situations that then I respond to with some strong negative emotion, that's because that strong negative emotion was already something that I was holding on inside myself. Which means that it was something from the past that I did not follow this instruction from Krishna of be free from attachment and aversion. I either held on to it and justified holding on to it. Well, I have a right to enjoy this anger because I've been wronged. I have a right to hold on to this fear because I've been traumatized. I have a right to hold on to this lust, you know, whatever, because I do it. I have a right to hold on to this greed because I was poor when I was young, you know, whatever it may be. So either we were holding on to something, justifying it, or we repressed it. Oh, I'm not supposed to feel angry. It's bad to feel angry. I don't really feel angry. So we were repressing it, which is another kind of holding it. You understand? Right? If I'm trying to enjoy something, then I'm holding it like this. And if I'm trying to repress it, then I'm holding it like this. Either way, I'm holding it. And then if I'm holding something, you know, somebody bumps me and then it comes out. All right, so the technique of spiritual life in bhakti for old stuff is to let it come to the surface. So for new stuff that's happening right now, I let it flow through me like just a river flowing through me. I can observe that it's flowing through me, or maybe I won't even notice because I'm so absorbed in Krishna that I'll hardly even notice. Or maybe I'll just notice momentarily, oh, look, there's envy, okay. Now, what were we doing over here for Krishna? You know, I don't hate it, I don't try to enjoy it, but if I've got this stuff down there, I need it to surface. I need it to surface so I can let it go. It's just like if you have a room, you know, you clean your room frequently. But if you have some part of your room that you haven't cleaned in a while, you have to get the dirt out in the open so you can sweep it up. Does that make sense? Right?
Yes.
You know, I haven't cleaned under the bed for 3 months, you know. I've got to bring that dirt out from under the bed into the middle of the floor so I can sweep it up. So we shouldn't let dirt accumulate under the, you know, I shouldn't be repressing and holding on to these things. But if I've done that in the past, now how are we going to get it up? Krishna has to do that. I mean, there are, you know, techniques that psychiatrists, psychologists, and therapists use that people can surface repressed emotions, and they may be useful, and we can certainly use them just like you'd go to a doctor if you had a broken arm. So there are techniques that one can use, journaling techniques and meditative techniques that can safely bring up repressed emotions. But we can also ask Krishna, you know, please help me to see these things so that I can see them properly and let go of them. So that I can see them properly and let go of them. And I've certainly asked Krishna that, and he certainly reciprocates with me when I've asked him that. You know, I remember there was a few years ago I asked him that, and then I could just feel there was all this anger that I had repressed. Obviously, I didn't know what I was angry at, and it doesn't even matter. And it just kind of came out, and I just experienced this in the body, and I just kind of watched it. You know, just kind of watched it. I kind of envisioned it as some kind of a creature. And I wasn't doing anything. I wasn't yelling, and I wasn't throwing anything, and I wasn't talking to anybody. I just kind of let those feelings be. I didn't try to repress them, and I didn't try to enjoy them. And then after a while, they just dissipated. And it was very interesting. After that, not only did I feel a lot more peaceful, but my health greatly improved, which was an interesting and welcome side effect. But, you know, you just ask Krishna, just, can you please help me, help to bring out these things that I've been avoiding and I've been hiding, and give me the ability to deal with it and let them go. You know, whatever they
need. Thank you so much.
Is that all right?
Yeah, it's perfect. Thank you.
And we do have to cooperate. By chanting Hare Krishna, those things will come out. But if we're not cooperative, we'll just shove them back down again. You know, it's like sometimes you say, oh man, I really need to do a deep cleaning. Oh, I don't even want to see what's in the back of the refrigerator. You know, you understand? Yeah? So we may think, my God,
yes.
I haven't cleaned out my refrigerator for 2 weeks. I know there's stuff in there. Oh my God, it's going to be so gross. I'll do it tomorrow. I'll do it the next day. So, you know, we have to cooperate. So bhakti does surface these old things. It does. But if we go, oh, I don't want to deal with that. Oh, it's depressing. Oh, it's disgusting. I don't know what I mean. And then we just shove it back down. You know, I think on some level we're very afraid to see this stuff. We're afraid we won't be able to handle it, or we're afraid that we'll lose something by letting go of it. And now I've gone way over time. We could actually talk about that for several hours, so I hope that's been sufficient that I gave a quick answer. And really, we should stop now, yes?
Well, I feel like we could go on, as you said, for hours, and it would be fine. The time would fly. And, this is stimulating to the intellect to have this discussion with you leading it, stimulating to the intellect, the spiritual intellect. As
Trishyanti cha, rimanti cha.
Yeah, yeah.
Okay, so now...
it's blissful. Thank you.
Thank you for giving me this opportunity.
Thank you so much. So if y'all would like to join me expressing appreciation, to Her Grace Urmila Mataji. Please join me now.
Thank you so much.